is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict. Diplomacy. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who's very generously agreed to comment on a new article at Foreign Affairs I recommend to everyone by Professors Monica Duffy Toft and Sedita Kushi, published most recently. The title does tell some of it, the roots of Washington's addiction to military force. But the larger story here is Washington draws the sword, drew the sword in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and now in Ukraine. And it doesn't come to success. The reasons for that are useful, and the policy ends of that are not promising. So I welcome Anatole to comment in general. He knows the professors personally. I do not. The emphasis here is how we got into this fix of always sending in troops and weapon systems and military assistance and not sending in the State Department and other arbiters in between the State Department and the Foreign Office of a rival power. The first thing that the professors point to as to how we do this is how we did it in the War on Terror. We dehumanized the enemy. That was the first thing we did. Do you measure that NATO has dehumanized the Russian force so that we're battling once again evil and villainy?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And of course, not just NATO, but the Western media in general and the political classes. And of course, I mean, there are so many reasons to condemn what Russia and the Russian army has done. But, I mean, there must at the same time be some self-awareness about past American actions, including Iraq and the behavior of the American army in Vietnam. Of course, many of us condemn these, but we did not turn that into a demonization, or at least sensible and decent people did not turn that into demonization of Americans as a people or the entire American tradition. Sensible people did not call for banning American composers and film directors. So, you know, while condemning Russian actions and, resisting Russian aggression, we must keep some, element at the same time of balance based, on an element of self-awareness and self-criticism.
Another observation by the professors, how we got into where we are today, which is NATO versus Russia in terms of weapon systems, priorities, expectations, the military contest dominating the world affairs, is that with the fall of the Soviet Union in 91, we Americans were persuaded that it was a unipolar world and we had the power and no one else did. I believe there were very famous essays in the 1990s pointing to the fact that the U.S. had won. That kind of supreme commanding thinking does move Washington to think that one more battalion will turn the argument in our favor. That was never true, I believe, now. Is there recognition in Europe that American power, American superpower, cannot win a battlefield?
Well, no. I mean, Europe has basically surrendered its entire, responsibility for its security to the United States to a somewhat astonishing degree, or at least it would have been astonishing to not just to Charles de Gaulle, but even, I think, to Margaret Thatcher. I think what has happened is that the so-called Wolfowitz doctrine, which when it was leaked under the administration of Bush the father, was very widely criticized in the US, has actually become the standard operating procedure of all succeeding US administrations, with obviously differences of nuance and tactics. And what the Wolfowitz doctrine said in 1992 was that the United States should become the permanent hegemon, not just in the world as a whole, but in every region of the world. And no other country would have any influence beyond its borders at all, except that explicitly allowed by the United States. And that countries will also have to reshape their domestic political systems and policies in accordance with US wishes. Well, you know, as was pointed out at the time, this was a program more ambitious than anything ever aimed at by any other country in the history of the world, and was bound to meet resistance. As it turns out, I mean, this has taken the form, obviously, in Russia of disastrous military pushback in Ukraine. And, of course, China rejects this absolutely. But it's worth pointing out that India, too, although India seeks partnership with America, but India has been absolutely unwilling to follow America in sanctions against Russia, in sanctions against Iran. And India is determined that any relationship with the US will be on India's terms, will not be dictated by Washington. So, you know, this program cannot succeed in a world of other great powers. I mean, it can lead to conflicts, and obviously it can do immense damage in the process to those powers, as we see in Ukraine today. But it cannot lead to a stable American-dominated world.
A third observation that follows on what you just presented, but from the professors, is how we got into this fix, is that the exit of the Soviet threat from Europe obliged or encouraged or at least permitted the U.S. to take risks with NATO. And that is the march towards the Russian frontier that was promised not to happen. It was not going to happen, but it did, piece by piece, through the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century. It's often cited in Moscow as the driver of the Ukraine invasion. I do not have experience with that march. Were there voices raised in protest as NATO got closer and closer to the Russian frontier and now sits on the Russian frontier?
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, three U.S. ambassadors to Moscow warned against this. Jack Matlock, Tom Pickering, and interestingly enough, William Burns, who is now the head of the CIA. But in his memoir, The Back Channel, which was published, of course, before he became CIA chief, he wouldn't publish it now. But he actually, you know, records his memos to the State Department as ambassador to Moscow, saying that NATO membership for Ukraine was the ultimate Russian red line, and that this was not just the position of Putin, but the position of the entire Russian establishment. Pickering said the same thing back in the 90s when, of course, Yeltsin was president. And, you know, we regarded Russia as a partner and a sort of quasi-democratic state. But Yeltsin also and his administration absolutely rejected the idea of NATO membership for Ukraine as a threat to vital Russian interests. So we cannot say that we weren't warned. We were warned again and again. And I as correspondent in Moscow in the 1990s, wrote repeatedly of the dangers of the of NATO expansion.
Did the military, the U.S. military or the NATO military, represent hesitation here, that putting weapon systems in reach of Moscow was a provocation, depending upon the politics in Moscow? I mean, there were changes going on here. There was early Putin, then there was Medvedev, then there was later Putin. So it wasn't all uniform. You couldn't see that Putin would transform himself from a man who signed a sympathy book about 9/11 into a hostile force. So were there voices that you heard, say, between 1998 and 2008, saying, wait a minute, we're provocative when we do this?
Well, I mean, there were political voices and diplomatic voices, but within the military, I mean, the problem was that when a real danger of war between NATO and Russia, or US and Russia, emerges, the military backs off. There was this famous occasion during the Russia-Georgia war of 2008 when Vice President Cheney proposed sending US troops to Georgia. And Robert Gates, but as defense secretary, but very much, you know, reflecting the views of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military commanders, said, absolutely not, no way. This is going to risk war with Russia, a nuclear superpower, you know, over what are essentially minor issues for U.S. interests. Okay, but Gates had not opposed the Bush administration's push for NATO membership for Georgia. And what did that mean? Well, that was going to mean a U.S. willingness to go to war with Russia for the sake of defending Georgia. So the problem is that people have only, if you like, woken up at the last moment, instead of opposing the whole strategy, which was extremely likely to lead to such wars. I had a fascinating conversation a number of years ago with an officer who had been on the NATO Secretary General's staff, Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, as it was then, during the 2008. And I asked him whether they had drawn up any contingency plans for a Russia-Georgia war. And he said, no, not merely did we not have any plans, the possibility of a war was not discussed in NATO headquarters. And I said, but how can that be? I mean, Georgia has made clear its determination to recover its lost territories. They are protected by Russian forces. How can you not have discussed this? And he said, it's very simple. The NATO expansion was sold to the European and the American public on the line that this involved no risks and no additional costs. So he said anyone who raised the possibility of serious risks had in effect declared themselves opponents of NATO expansion. And at that point, he said, your career would have been ruined. You would have been sent back, you know, to your capital in disgrace and never been promoted again.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, reflecting on a new essay at Foreign Affairs about the sword, not the plow, from the United States for these many years since the end of the Soviet Union. We'll turn now to the present circumstance, why the plow is preferable, especially when coming up against a new superpower. That would be China. I'm John Batchelor.